The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On this week's podcast, we examine the carbon footprint of things you've never even considered examining, from searching for something in Google to factors affecting different modes of transport.
Well, I'm not trying to say don't go cycling, but if you were to be powered entirely by air-freighted asparagus, you know, you would be better off driving a Hummer.
But will this knowledge help us save the world?
I do think the psychology of it is incredibly interesting. I don't think we understand how to get on top of it. We are, you know, we are the frogs in a slowly heating bowl of water.
You may have seen something about spoof Jenks doing the rounds on the internet this week. Well, after writing an article critical of science, we tracked down columnist Simon Jenkins to defend his words.
It's as if science was almost ethereal. It was a good beyond price. Nothing's good beyond price. This is not a religion. It's science.
And what would music sound like if we used DNA code to compose it? Well, exactly like this, actually. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. In this studio today are The Guardian's Nell Bowes and The Observer's science editor, Robin McKee. Plus, our special guest is Mike Berners-Lee. Now, if that name sounds a bit familiar, you might have heard of his brother, Tim, who's credited with inventing the World Wide Web. Mike is the director of an associate company of Lancaster University, specialising in organisational responses to climate change. He's also the author of a new book called How Bad Are Bananas, which details the carbon footprint of everything. Mike, welcome. It must have been a tricky book to compile this, a bit of a numbers nightmare.
It's not about being absolutely precise about this, but it is about trying to get the numbers of zeros right so that you understand, for example, you know, whether something is 1,000 times more carbon intensive than something else. A broad impression of roughly how large things are.
So roughly speaking, for say, going back to our banana, what's involved in the carbon footprint of a banana?
There'll be the emissions that take place on the plantation where it's grown, and possibly fertilizers and so on going into the agricultural process. There'll be a range of gases typically coming off anything agricultural, some methane, some nitrous oxide, and some carbon dioxide. And then there'll be some transport emissions, with the case of bananas, a little bit of packaging. But the big deal is likely to take place in the farm.
What's the difference between an organic and an inorganic banana? Is that the main feature?
Some research that's out there is saying that actually very often organic doesn't give you a carbon benefit, can actually be worse. Within the organic label, you can air freight under some circumstances. That's clearly, you know, very high carbon. So organic and low carbon don't necessarily go together. Transport gets a very high profile for food, but it's worth saying it's not usually the biggest deal. If something hasn't gone on an aeroplane, then it's unlikely that the transport is the problem with it. So, for example, apples from New Zealand are probably quite a low-carbon food because apples are a low-carbon food and the shipping of them isn't a huge deal. If you were to put an apple on an aeroplane, that would be a very different story. It would be about 100 times more carbon-intensive for the transport part of it.
Okay. Nell, do you have any examples you've picked out?
Yeah, well, I was interested in stuff other than food. I remember that hoo-ha a while ago about Google searches and how the carbon footprint. What's carbon footprint of computer use?
It comes from all sorts of different places, the first thing to say about it. So, you know, when you turn on a computer, you start using some electricity and that has a carbon footprint. That's the obvious bit. The machine that you're using needs to be manufactured, and you might think, well, it's just a couple of kilos of plastic and metal. But actually, if you look at the very technical processes that are required to make those components that might each weigh a gram or two, you start getting estimates of the carbon footprint of the whole thing that might come out, you know, up to a ton for a laptop, say. So that's the embodied carbon in the machine itself, and then that's just the stuff that's going on at your end. If you do a Google search, Google have got data centers, and they use a lot of energy themselves, and there is a whole network that you need to use in order for your messages to go both ways, and all of that equipment has also got embodied emissions associated with it. So you have to add all of that up if you want to try and get an estimate of it, and it's quite hard to be precise, but various different ways of estimating that give us a perspective that says that actually it's enough that it should be on our radar.
Yeah. How does it compare sort of on an order of magnitude with my normal diet over a year, my use of a computer over a year?
It'll be smaller. So food is reckoned to be about 20% of the UK's carbon footprint. If you don't take into account changes in land use, such as deforestation, in which case you might get up to about 30%. Whereas, your laptop might be a ton ago-ish, perhaps a bit less than that, and you might replace it every year or two. So it might be, it might come up to a few percent, perhaps, of your carbon footprint and a bit of electricity. Data centres around the world, my estimate was they're about 0.25% of the world's carbon footprint, but possibly rising to maybe around 0.5%. So it all deserves a place on our radar.
0.5%, that's not massive. And I suppose, and Google itself is looking at green energy. It's been investing in wind farms and wants to try and source power for its data centres from these sorts of green energy projects. I mean, electricity can't be an evil forever, can it? Because if we do manage to somehow clean it up, then we can kind of get rid of the electricity carbon emissions. I mean, that's not
and
so bad.
The day when we've got abundant green energy, all the numbers in my book will change completely, because every time there's any electricity in there, the carbon intensity of it is different. Having things manufactured in different countries using electricity, because the carbon intensity of electricity is different, is higher in China from over here, for example, that makes a difference.
Okay, and this is one I know that Robin's really interested in, the red roses.
Well, all this is based on a study that Cranfield University did actually for a flower producer, so you need to kind of take it in that context a little bit. But they did a study which had a look at flying roses from Kenya for the UK market against growing them in Holland in hothouses for the UK market, and they came out with some figures which said that although the air freight is pretty high carbon because aeroplanes burn so much fuel, actually hot housing them in Holland was even worse, and you end up with a surprisingly high figure. So
how reliable was that, though? I mean, as you said, you take that caveat to the fact that it was done for the flower manufacturer.
We did our own sums around it a little bit to sense check them, and we found ourselves questioning bits, but in terms of order of magnitude, we found them extremely plausible. So the hot housing from Holland option came in at about a couple of kilos for a single red rose, for which you could have 4.5 kilos of bananas. So that's your Valentine's Day. I know someone who's tried it. They said they managed to make it romantic.
How romantic, yes.
No, but bouquet of bananas.
The trouble with that equation is, of course, that it's not just carbon's the issue, because water is a significant issue in Kenya, and it's not an issue in Holland. And to grow these plants, to grow these flowers in Kenya, there's an immense amount of fresh water has been run off for some of the Great Lakes there. So, I mean, I'm sure you know this better than I do, but I mean, we do have to have a sense of balance when we consider the carbon cost. There are other penalties involved.
Yes, and my book looks primarily down the carbon lens, but I try to flag up other issues when they come up. Absolutely, nobody should ever make a decision looking only at the carbon. There are always other sustainability issues. I try to point them out in the book. Mm. But we should keep that wider perspective, very definitely.
Just thinking about the Kenyan roses lying in heaps, I know the Iceland volcano is fairly recent, but have you got a way of sort of thinking about the carbon emissions or the from the volcano or the savings on the flights grounded? I mean, how's that all sort of racking out now?
Okay, so somebody somewhere is probably beavering away doing the detailed analysis of this, but
back of the envelope,
the volcano itself is likely to have sent a few million tons worth of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which will have had a warming effect, and carbon dioxide has a long lifetime, so that will last as carbon dioxide does. It will also have spewed, as we know, a whole load of dust into the atmosphere, and that has a cooling effect, but that cooling effect has a much shorter lifetime. Now, the other thing that will have happened is that it grounded a few flights for a few days. That will be, probably a lot less significant than all that carbon dioxide going up there. But if it changed any habits at all, who knows, it might have been a win. So I know some people who were due to have an international conference when the volcano was going on, and they had a choice between cancelling the conference and doing the whole thing virtually. Now, they would they hadn't chosen before that to do it virtually, thinking, well, we won't be able to have such a good conference and so on. Maybe they were forced into the experiment, and maybe it worked, and maybe they'll do that next time, so save a whole lot of time and money and carbon and so on. So if it changed a few habits, it could be a win. I also read some stuff about how aeroplane engines might be damaged by this, by any of this dust, for the rest of their lives and be that much less efficient. So in that case, you know, all aviation may have got less efficient for the next few decades. So it's, you know, it's complicated, and there are factors both ways.
Actually, there's a really interesting thing in there which I wanted to ask, is how much does knowledge of these stats or of these books change? Does it affect how people actually behave?
Well, let's put it this way. If you don't have an understanding in broad terms of the orders of magnitude, and, you know, are the plastic bags the big deal in your lives, or is it the flying or whatever, then you can't take meaningful action. And there's good evidence out there that says that actually, you know, if people do something that turns out to be insignificant, but they feel really good about it, and then they go and do a bit more flying, or, you know, there's a likelihood that actually they'll do more of some of the things that really do matter, and you can end up with a higher carbon lifestyle. So let's put it this way. If you haven't got the numbers, you can't do anything about it. Just, you know, at least a broad perspective on that. Whether having the numbers then makes you live a lower carbon lifestyle, I don't know. Actually, I think the challenge of how we respond to this whole climate change thing is really interesting. I think the psychology of it is incredibly interesting. Collectively as a society, we're not managing it so far. The data is saying that we are not on top of this problem. But the book is all about trying to suggest that actually most of us have got junk in our lives that gives us nothing, gives nothing to the quality of our existence. If we can identify it, be open-minded, prepared to change a few habits, actually we can all live better and lower carbon, and the wins are there to be had.
Well, what was one of the favourite or most surprising things you found out in researching this?
Well, I enjoyed some of the stuff about cycling and different ways of cycling. Depending on what you eat, cycling has a different carbon footprint.
Really?
Which is in there for, you know,
by methane.
Well, it's in there for fun, but it makes a very serious point too, because the truth of it is that if you're powered by kind of sensible breakfast food like bananas and muesli and toast and stuff like that, cycling is an incredibly low carbon activity.
So you
as
have to think
expect.
About the source of fuel for all your clean energy, all your cycling and things as well.
Well, I'm not trying to say don't go cycling, but
what's the other extreme?
The other extreme is that if you were to be powered entirely by air freighted asparagus, don't try this on long distance slides. You know, you would be better off driving a Hummer, actually.
that's unbelievable.
The message there is not don't go cycling. The message there is don't have too
that's,
much peruvian
that's a pub
asparagus.
Story if ever I've heard one. Mike,
take that away.
Your book finishes with an interesting thing. It finishes on a page with a full stop, which might not be so odd for book authors. I mean, books finish with full stops, but you make a real point of this full stop, to excuse the pun.
Yeah, the point of the full stop is that one of the lowest carbon things we can do is just to think about things, actually. So if you spend time reading a book, or, you know, even watching telly, even though it's got a very obvious carbon footprint, turns out to be a low carbon activity. And, you know, lots of the greatest things we can do in life actually don't have any carbon footprint at all with them.
What was the most egregious, pointless waste of carbon that you came across?
Well,
newspapers.
Newspapers aren't too bad, because you sit there and you spend time with them, and you're not doing anything else. You're not driving while you read them, probably. So they're not too bad. Everybody knows flying's got a huge carbon footprint. I think it's, most people don't understand quite how big a carbon footprint it's got. I think it's about 12% flying and air freight. Together, it's about 12% of the UK's carbon footprint, so it's a very big deal. And some of that flying is for really essential, important journeys. Some of it's for people travelling on holidays, for holidays of a lifetime and stuff like that. And some of it is just gunk. Some of it is just people getting on an aeroplane to fly to the other part of the world to go and stay in a hotel that's as similar as they can find to the one down the road, and have the cultural experiences that are as similar to the ones they could have down the road, and then come home again. And actually, if they just went to the hotel down the road, they'd save some money and have a 2-day longer holiday. And so, you know, some of it's just rubbish. And I think this is a really interesting challenge, for example, for universities. You know, they have these conferences and people fly off all over the place, and sometimes that's really important, and I'm sure sometimes it couldn't be done by a video conference and all that stuff. And sometimes actually you just get on the plane and it's not very interesting, and you come home again and it's taken a lot of time and money, and you're just, you know. So Some things have a big carbon footprint, but they're worth it. You know, I think the World Cup has got a big carbon footprint, but I think it's worth it because whether or not you love football, billions of people do. In one sense, it's one of the things that brings the people of the world together in almost a way that nothing else does. So, you know, I'd say it's probably worth it. It's a couple of million tons of
You can measure the carbon input.
I made a very crude, don't take it too seriously, estimate of a couple of million tons. I think that came out at 2.8 million tons. But that's for billions of hours worth of top quality entertainment for many people.
In your darkest moments, do you think we're going to be able to tackle these emissions, this emissions problem? I mean, it doesn't look like governments are going to agree to actually cut their emissions very much around the world. Copenhagen was a failure. Mexico in 2010, when they meet again, isn't guaranteed to do anything. Are you optimistic?
I wouldn't describe myself, if truth be told, as massively optimistic, but I don't think it's a done deal that we're not going to get on top of this. I mean, I do think the psychology of it is incredibly interesting. I don't think we understand how to get on top of it. We are, you know, we are the frogs in a slowly heating bowl of water. We've noticed what's happening to us. The psychology of human denial is incredibly interesting to watch going on. And somehow we need to find a way collectively of getting through that. And when we do that, we'll start responding. One of the sort of classic tricks, psychological tricks that we all employ is to find a way that even if we accept it, it's somebody else who needs to act. And governments do that and businesses do that and people do that. And I think, you know, I would challenge all of that. I actually think anybody, any business, any organization, any government can do their thing on their own and actually they help everybody else to act as well. So the responsibility is absolutely with all of us.
Mike's book, How Bad Are Bananas, is out now. If you want to follow this podcast on Twitter, you can search for our handle, which is @ScienceWeekly, where you'll find out whenever anything new is launched. And if you want to be alerted to the rest of the Guardian science content, you can follow Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
My name is Michael Zev Gordon, and I'm the composer of this piece of music. It's called Allele, and it's made out of DNA coding. When I was confronted with that genetic material, I saw before me on the page a series of letters, A's, C's, G's and T's, which stand for, as I've come to understand, the chemical bases which constitute DNA. They also struck me immediately as musical notes. A's, C's and G's obviously as notes, and T, if you take from the do, re, mi solfège system, a B. I played around with some rhythms, and before I knew it, I had, as a starting musical gesture, something that was surprisingly like a bit of plain song, and that is where the piece of music that you're hearing begins from. I began with a single sequence, but I quickly came to understand that DNA, the double helix being at the heart of it, also comes with a complement. And so the piece begins with a single line of notes, and then it multiplies into two as I use that complement. And so on and so forth, the piece replicates and replicates. Another image, obviously, from genetics. The piece is for 40 voices, and the musical starting point from that is a piece from long ago by the Renaissance English composer Thomas Tallis. Recently, various composers have started taking that extraordinary challenge on, and it seemed to me and to the scientists involved the most immediate and direct way of somehow having these genes put into music, these genes being sung. I came to understand that we are more than 99% identical in terms of our genes, but the crucial 1%, the polymorphisms, as they're called, along the genetic sequence, is what comes to give us our individuality. And the individual genes are known as alleles, which of course gave rise to the title of my piece. As the piece develops and the lines multiply, they build and build, and eventually they reach a point where all 40 voices are singing separate parts at once. At this climax, I was given another kind of data. Not letters, but numbers, lengths of bases, and I turned those numbers, those lengths, into lengths of musical phrase, each different according precisely to the singers who are singing the piece. As well as a collaboration with the scientist and with science, this was a collaboration with the poet, Ruth Padell. When we talked about the words and the music and how they would fit together, she came up with a wonderful set of lines that meditated upon the mystery, as we both saw it, of this hard matter, and also particularly of the image of the tiniest difference at the heart of the sequence, which gives rise to our individualities. At the same time, I also thought it might be interesting to further integrate the science, the words and the music, if we could find a structure that the text and the music could have in common. And I drew on another natural phenomenon for that, the golden section or the Fibonacci series, which has such a lot to do with the optimum formation of many, many forms in nature, and has in fact been used by composers a great deal to structure their music. I asked Ruth to structure her text in that way and my music in that way, and at the golden section of the piece, where the singers come to sing their 40 individual parts, she placed a particular line, mystery of tiniest difference, allele, occult as Kabbalah, and the singers break into this 40 voice unsynchronized wash of sound. I think music always needs something precise to work, as it were, against for creativity to flow. Whether that precision is exactly science or not, I don't know, but something of the image of science is helpful in thinking about music for me as a composer, and perhaps it's helpful for others to think that composers and artists, poets in general, do not work in a purely fanciful way. We need frameworks, we need constructions to work within, and as I say, to work against, for the music, for the art to flow.
Michael Zev Gordon talking about his composition Allele. It was performed by the New London Chamber Choir and conducted by James Weeks. You can catch performances of Allele on the 9th of July at the Diamond Synchrotron, on the 10th of July at the Cheltenham Music Festival, and on the 13th at the Royal Society of Medicine. The details are on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. For the past week, the science Twitter sphere has been buzzing around an article written by a Guardian columnist. It follows Simon Jenkins' latest attack on science, in which he described Royal Society President Martin Rees as shameless and two-faced. Rather than anger, though, it's prompted an unconventional and hilarious reaction, as well as the new hashtag on Twitter, SpoofJenks. Everyone took to their blogs and Twitter accounts to rubbish science in the style of Simon Jenkins. So we called up the man himself to find out what he made of it all.
Well, I'm delighted if they think they can spoof it. I don't think many of them have got the point, which is not that I'm for or against science. It's just that I don't think science requires particularly favourable treatment at a time when public expenditure is being cut.
So in terms of public money, you mean in terms of research funds or infrastructure funds, money for future research?
Yes, exactly what I mean. Why do they claim to be treated better than the health service or the education service?
Would you say that that's what they claim, though?
Yes.
So who claims that?
I mean, Martin Rees used the Rees lectures, among other things. I may say is very entertaining lectures, and he's a splendid chap. But he used them, among other things, to plead for more money for science at a time of extreme financial shortage. And I think that's he's welcome to do it, but I don't see why I shouldn't point it out.
Doesn't science have a place in the future in terms of economic value, for example, or intellectual value, or even, as you say in your own piece, there's wonder in this enterprise?
I totally accept that, and all I'm saying is I don't see why we shouldn't point out that's what they're doing. What actually Martin was trying to do, I thought, was he was trying to imply that science is on a different plane from everybody else's activity, and therefore should be excused from the pain. And indeed, the language that he and some of his colleagues often use is as if science was almost ethereal. It was a good beyond price. Nothing's a good beyond price. This is not a religion. It's science. And I just don't see how you can divorce science from the same constraints that other people have to accept.
What are those constraints? For example, are you talking about, for example, economic value? Are you suggesting that science doesn't have the same economic value as something else?
No, I'm saying that you prove it does.
And in what way do they not, for example, you talk about the Large Hadron Collider in your piece and the question asked at the Reith lectures about whether that money might have been better spent elsewhere. You suggest energy research, and no one can deny that energy research is woefully underfunded given the climate change problem. But how is it even possible to start deciding what economic value the Large Hadron Collider might have in 20, 30, 100 years? And how would you expect scientists to make that case?
That's their problem, not mine. They're asking for a huge sum of public money. They can't persuade the private sector to finance it. They want it to be judged against other uses for public money, and they must make the case. That's all I'm saying.
But the Large Hadron Collider, for example, was the reason that we have the World Wide Web, and that's a value that you can barely begin to explain.
Well, there are those who say that's rubbish. There are those who say that we have the World Wide Web because of defense expenditure, or we have it because of space research. Every single...
Well, no, that's not true. The World Wide Web came from CERN, the particle physics lab, where the Large Hadron Collider is now built.
Yes.
And it came as a way for scientists to share information back in 1989. I mean, Tim Berners-Lee, who invented it, will tell you that.
Well,
that's clearly something which has been developed by private money since, but it wouldn't have been invented if it wasn't for this this particular application.
Well, That I just don't believe that's the case. It would have been prevented for another reason, the same as Einstein's laws of thermodynamics would have been invented by somebody else.
Einstein didn't make the laws of thermodynamics, but he was general relativity. But the thermodynamics, for example, gave us the Industrial Revolution, gave us all the mechanization of Western society.
I don't see the argument here. I mean, the religion gave us Durham Cathedral. It's not an argument for Durham Cathedral. Defence expenditure, which is by far the largest area of science, gives us massive offspin from that. It's not an argument for defence expenditure any more than flying to the moon was an argument for non-stick frying pans, which is always cited. Unless science wants to be regarded as completely zany in its claim, it's got to make a coherent, rational claim for public money, the same as everybody else. And this they resolutely decline to do.
So who do you think does make a really rational claim for money in a time like this? Who's made the best claim? And who would you say, if I was a scientist, who should I copy in terms of the way they make their claims?
I give you exact example of that. I would have said that Alzheimer's research, which I have followed a bit, every single penny that's spent on Alzheimer's research seems to me and to others to yield some advance in the science and understanding of the brain and diseases of the brain. Cancer research, it seems to me, is far less successful. But these are areas of science which yield a palpable public gain from money spent in the same way that hospice treatment does. I think most people can understand those. In some of these wilder areas of science, you make a reasonable point, which is that you don't quite know what advantage you get from down the line. But that's a problem for science. It's not a problem for the rest of us. When people simply say, give me the money, it's like spending money on opera. I mean, why should I spend vast sums of money on opera when people say, oh, well, it's a good, don't you know, and leave it at that?
Which is a fair point. But if you think about, say, for example, Alzheimer's research, as you say, there's an aging society. We need to think about these issues more, and we're going to need drugs and understanding. But all of that understanding is based on basic research done in the 70s, 60s on brains, which no one really knew where it was going to go at all. So it took 30 or 40 years before anyone could understand it. Going back, I don't know, 20 years, would you have funded the Human Genome Project, the sequencing of the human genome?
Well, that to me, when I remember reading the early material on that, that seemed to me to have a benefit that I could understand that was as you say, very much over the horizon. But it was leading in a direction, a sort of a route of travel that I could understand. Flying to the moon never did. But flying to the moon was hugely popular, and therefore we flew to the moon. It had some spin-offs, and also they claim, in the same way I'm sure the Hadron Collider has spin-offs. But particularly at a time like this, you, all I'm saying is you've got to argue the case through. If you simply say, anyone who objects to my particular project is anti-science, that's just stupid to me.
Many scientists would say you were anti-science, so would you defend yourself against that?
Well, that's like anybody who starts to discuss religion being called anti-religion. I mean, if I challenge the Roman Catholic Church, am I anti-religion? If I may say so, this is it's like people who question the swine flu procedure or the ash cloud. You're anti-science if you challenge science on its own grounds. And I think that's about as anti-science of an approach as you could possibly have. If these people are not prepared to argue their case, they just abuse anyone who criticizes them. And I think they're betraying their own cause.
Do you think that in the longer, for the bigger aim of all of this, the science is a good thing for society? They just need to improve the way that they ask for money.
Yes, I think that's a very good way of putting it. That would improve. I mean, they got to ask for money properly. I can well remember someone who ran the Royal Opera House. When I said, I think you ought to explain why it is that you want £100 subsidy every ticket, he screamed, why are you so anti-opera? And that's about the level of this debate at the moment.
And if they were to ask you for advice, would you sit down and take them through it?
I often have, yes.
I mean, because
I've addressed the British Association for the Advancement of Science on just this subject on two or three occasions. I've got no problem with this. I just think that frankly, these are moments when scientists sound very stupid.
Well, I mean, that's a challenge perhaps for scientists to take up, I think. I mean, you've given some good points for them to think about. If they were to sit down and ask you to come and have a debate with them, would you be prepared to do it?
Totally. Always have.
Okay. Simon, that's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay.
I might even organise that debate. I'll hold you to that.
Okay.
To read more about spoof janks, go to our blog.
News Jank.
A new genetic test can predict your chances of living to 100. Researchers at Boston University say they've uncovered the genetic markers associated with living to a ripe old age, and they say it's 77% accurate.
Scientists have found evidence of lower IQs in people living in countries where disease is rife. It's because energy can be diverted away from brain development to fight infection. Scientists in the US say the controversial idea might help explain why national IQ scores differ around the world and are lower in some warmer countries where debilitating parasites such as malaria are widespread.
Controversy surrounds the appointment of two MPs to the UK's Health Select Committee. Some are describing them as dumb and dumber. Despite an election pledge to take an evidence-based approach to health, the Tories have appointed Nadine Dorries and David Tredenick. One attracted ridicule for claiming that an unborn fetus could punch its way out of the womb, while another is a supporter of astrology who once asserted that blood doesn't clot under a full moon.
Let's have a look now at some of the other science stories around this week with Nell and science correspondent Ian Sample. Ian, the genetic test that can predict your chances of living to 100. I'm always a bit cautious about genetic tests for anything, but this is the scientists themselves saying there's a possibility of testing this.
It's probably the largest genetic study of centenarians that's ever been done. And what they did is they looked for SNPs, so basically single letter changes in their genetic code, and compared them to a control group. So what they ended up finding were 150 of these genetic markers, if you like, which are more common in centenarians than they are in the sort of your average Joe. And what they then did is, with those 150, they went to a separate group of people and tested them for these particular markers. And then it turns out that with these markers, you can test to within 77% accuracy whether that person is likely to become really old age, which is living really beyond sort of 95.
What was the population they tested?
Well, the population they tested was it was over 1,000 people. They were all signed up to a New England study. They were all Caucasian, which is interesting. I mean, I discussed this with the researchers, and they say that these longevity markers may well differ dramatically if you go and look in other populations, so in Asia and Africa and such like. They may be sort of markers in similar genes, but you would expect them to be different. I think what's actually a more interesting, perhaps geekier point about this study that I really liked was that you'd imagine that someone who lives at an extremely long time wouldn't have many risk genes for things like Alzheimer's, high blood pressure, things like that. What they found is actually the controls and the centenarians had pretty similar numbers of those risk genes for disease. What the centenarians had more of were kinds of genes that help cancel out those. So they're actually sort of protective genes. And why this is interesting is, if you look at all of the genetic tests on the market from companies like 23andMe and Decode and so on, they all look for risk genes. Whereas these guys are saying it's an early finding, but they're saying actually what is probably more important are whether you've got the genes which actually keep those diseases at bay. And almost all of these old people, they just delay the onset of age-related diseases.
No?
It's quite interesting, this finding, given the debates that you've had about what kind of access insurance companies should have to people's private data and things like that. There's, you know, it's quite a nice example of, are they doing the wrong test and making judgments based on the wrong test? And is this going to feed into the ongoing debate?
I think it will inevitably, but this whole idea that protective genes are more important than risk genes, that whole idea, I think, has to be more substantiated before that happens. But I think these companies are probably very much already onto this idea. But one of the things they're up against is that so many of the genetic studies so far have looked for risk genes for diseases, that there aren't that many out there which look for protective genes against the disease. So they can't do a test. And obviously, these are commercial companies. They want to test for something and charge people for it. So almost, you know, they can't do it yet. But
you might imagine it's actually quite difficult to predict what the protective genes might be. The protective genes might go across many different diseases, for example, or there might be lots in parts of the genome that people aren't really studying very much. Some of the in the last few weeks, we've been talking about the 10th anniversary of the human genome, and one of the guys who was responsible for sequencing that effort at the Sanger Center in Cambridge did actually make this point that we are sequencing more and more people, finding risk genes in them, yet they're not developing those diseases, and we have absolutely no idea why. And so this idea that a gene or even a combination of genes causes something is just, it's disappearing as a concept.
This really was the most important part for me. I think the whole idea of there being a test that will see whether you're going to live to a long age is kind of interesting, but it's nowhere near as interesting to me as the actual information this tells you about the biology of aging. And I think if they can find out certain genes that definitely delay, you know, it probably in concert with other genes, definitely delay the onset of certain genes, and then you can, you know, produce drugs which you know, mimic the effect of those particular variants that the centenarians have, you're looking at a really nice, potential avenue of discovery in medicine.
Okay, well, let's move on to another story. This one, perhaps a bit controversial, difficult to
just
report. this one is about the headline is lower IQs found in disease-rife countries, scientists claim.
So this is a study from a controversial group of scientists already at the University of New Mexico. They have a bit of a track record. Now, they're putting forward a hypothesis. They're not saying that they think this is, they've not got any proof for this idea, but they're saying that it may be, well, they want to investigate the possibility that disease burden in countries damages or causes problems for brain development in children and results in poorer cognitive ability. Now, even saying that is the interesting thing in a way is even saying that is deeply controversial, because you're basically saying because these countries are nearer the equator, they're more tropical, they have more diseases, they're almost condemned to be having, you know, in these authors' views, poor brain development. And they then go and, you know, try and test, and I'm sort of doing that in inverted commas, this hypothesis by looking at how scores on IQ tests, which are a very sort of, you know, pretty dubious way of measuring intelligence around the world, see whether they how they fit with infectious load, infectious disease, the amount of parasites around and such like, and they find a correlation. They're not saying, okay, so we have proof and that's what's going on, but they've written this up and it was in a Royal Society journal. And it's an interesting idea, but it's so deeply controversial, it's almost impossible to write about without getting blasted.
So what happened next? Well, you wrote about the story. What was the reaction?
The reaction was exactly as expected, I'd have to say. I mean,
there's the debate here whether to let it lie and just let it sort of sink like a stone because the findings aren't that conclusive and therefore doesn't warrant reporting yet, or, you know, if ever, versus being scared scared about reporting stuff because it's going to get a hugely controversial backlash.
Yeah, I mean, the overwhelming thing on my mind when I decided to write this up was that you can't be afraid of writing something because people aren't going to like what the scientists are saying. Now, you have to be careful with that attitude, and I think I was. But this was in a Royal Society journal, and sometimes things come up and you think, this is likely to get covered. And this isn't kind of an arrogant thing to say, but I think there was almost a duty on you to think, well, if this is going to get covered anyway, we should really put this paper out to the brightest people we can find, get their views on it, and put out a version which is as sane and accurate as possible. Now, and that, so that's what, you know, I tried to do with the story. I think it is what the flaw in the study is not so much the hypothesis; it's that the test that they did can give you a correlation without telling you. Doesn't tell you. You know beforehand almost that doing that study, looking to see how IQ scores, if they correlate with this, it doesn't tell you whether it's right or not. It could never tell you whether
tell
the hypothesis is right or not.
Is it?
No, it doesn't. So why do it? And so I think it's dubious, and I think it's dubious that the Royal Society accepted it. And it's questionable whether I should have covered it, absolutely. I tell you what, the temptation is actually, you know, if something like this comes up again, can you really, is it worth it?
Do you think Randy Thornhill is just pushing those buttons, you know, got form in terms of the natural history of rape? And I noticed Ened Yong had brought out a lot of the recent studies that his group has done on relating IQ to religion and war.
Infectious
and
load. He's related infectious load with all sorts of other things.
Societal factors and things like that, where you kind of go, all right, so are you just on a mission here?
Yeah, I don't know what his motivation is on this. And the idea is, you know, if you measure one thing against another enough times, you will find a correlation. But it doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't back up any causative theory you might have. So why do it? It's an interesting one, which I don't have an answer to.
We'll leave that there. And you can leave your thoughts on our blog, of course. Everything you want to know about those stories is at guardian.co.uk/science or environmentguardian.co.uk. Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks to Nell Bowes, Ian Sample, Robin McKee and Mike Berners-Lee. Next week, cosmologist Hiranya Pyrus will be joining us in the studio to discuss the role of universities in society and the economy. She also does lots of clever theoretical stuff with the cosmic microwave background, so listen in for that. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Make sure you subscribe while you're there so that every podcast gets automatically delivered to any MP3 device you might own. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. To finish this podcast, let's hear that DNA music again, but this time without the talking all over it. Allele is composed by Michael Zev Gordon, and it's performed by the New London Chamber Choir, conducted by James Weeks. Invisible.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.